Field Marshal Carver, Reel 2. Still on the field of wireless, how proceduralized was the method of things like speaking over the air? Was it very tightly controlled, or was it fairly informal?
Well, it was very tightly controlled in order to cut down the length of transmissions.
Mm-hmm. What were the procedures? If you can
recall. Well, I can't remember what the actual procedures were, but I mean, there were the usual procedure for establishing communication and for ending it. And one used codes of various sorts, partly for security reasons, not that they really were secure, but mainly in order to cut down the length of, in order to transmit the information or the orders in the shortest possible period of time.
Could you tell me a bit more about the problems of operating these sets, the kind of problems which you had to face with, which illustrate this, their limitations?
Well, as I said, they went off tune very quickly. They were not, as it were today, you could tune with a number and expect it to stick on it. I think the first sets we had were crystal controlled. It was quite a job tuning, getting everybody on net at the beginning of the day, for instance, or at the beginning of an exercise. And then they would very quickly get off net. You were constantly having to retune. And then you've got power failures, and then your aerial would hit something and you'd have to tune all over again. It was this keeping the sets on net and in tune, which was one of the major problems. The other was, of course, that there was a great deal of interference, particularly at night. And this reduced, of course, the range at which you could expect to get good speech. And indeed, rain, you've got a lot of rain. You were very, very easily screened by buildings. This, of course, to do with the power, by trees and everything else. So it was because the use of radio sets of that sort was in its infancy at the time that it was very difficult to assure good communication all the time. You were constantly having to work at it in a way the present day radio operator that doesn't have to do half as much. You can expect his set to remain on net and functioning much more than you could in those days.
If they went off tune, was it a lengthy process retuning?
It was a lengthy compared to changing frequencies of today, but it depended rather on what the chap in control was doing. I mean, if he was standing stationary and was in a nice clear place and had a big aerial up, it was probably easier for you to tune to him. Mm-hmm. Same with yourself. But if you were on the move, and it was raining, and you were going in and out of trees, and of course it was extremely difficult.
To what extent were you able to transmit and receive on the move?
Well, if your set was working properly, mm-hmm. you could. But of course you got better results if you put yourself on top of a hill and put up an extra bit of aerial and were not banging about.
This period from 1935 onwards, when wireless was being taken increasingly more seriously, did the Tank Corps retain any other forms of communication, and if so, for what sort of purposes were they
used?
Well,
it did. Within the section, as it was called then, and even to a certain extent within the company, I think, but certainly within the section, you were not really supposed to use radio for communicating within the section when I joined. You were supposed to control your tanks, the formation they moved and anything else like that, by either flag signals or hand signals or even lamp. There was a lamp which came up and you were supposed to send little more messages in lamp. All this was a hangover from those members of the Corps joined it from the Navy, I think. But flag and lamp and hand signals never really worked. Couldn't see them.
So you had, in fact, not yet reached a point where all communication by any means was carried out exclusively by wireless?
Well, it wasn't meant to be. But flag and lamp and hand signals hardly ever worked properly, so that as soon as everybody had got radio, they in fact used it.
Mm. Mainly Hubbard-directed propaganda campaign and efforts to get wireless increasingly used, were they reflected in the kind of exercises Brigade did during summer training?
Well, all exercises of company size and above, of course, had to use radio. It was the only way they could be controlled.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to get some impressions of the ways in which employment during the exercises of tanks was becoming influenced by the increasingly greater availability of wireless.
Well, it meant, of course, that things could go more quickly and things could be in much less of a stereotype fashion. I suppose it meant that on the whole people tried to do rather more complicated things than they would have tried to do before.
Can you illustrate that with any examples from the exercises in 36 and 37?
Well, I don't think I can, really, because I don't know what they were like before. Mm-hmm. But there was certainly one very wide-ranging exercise that we were made to do when we were sent all over Salisbury Plain. This was supposed to be a tank force that had erupted behind the enemy's lines, and you were having to, as it were, live off the country and operate without supply from your own side for a period of time. The idea being you picked up your petrol where you could, you got your food where you could, and all that. And we were given sums of money to buy food with and to buy petrol with. And we all dashed about all over Salisbury Plain and round, having a marvellous time. But I don't think it bore much relation to an actual serious military operation. But it involved much greater distances from each other than you normally were when you were just on the training area on the centre of the plane itself.
Yes.
I mean, if you were just grinding up and down between Tidworth at one end and Warminster at the other, then, of course, the distances were never very large.
Of the 1936 exercises, Hobart is quoted as saying the tank brigade this year was worse equipped than it has ever been, and the exercises were seriously handicapped as a result.
Yes, well, that was because the first tanks had gone to Egypt,
mm-hmm.
and had taken, and the first tanks, having been formed to be the light battalion of the tank brigade, had taken away practically all the light tanks of the brigade. But then they were sent off to Egypt to deal with the Abyssinian War. And the tank brigade was left with nothing but its old medium tanks. And as I've said, Carden Lloyd carriers and old things like that. And the first tanks, of course, had been given absolute priority for radio sets and everything else. And so there was a great shortage of everything.
Can we talk a bit about the formation, the development of the 1st Tank Division under Brooke?
I wasn't knew nothing about it. I was in Egypt at the time.
Oh, I see.
7th okay. Armour Division I can tell you all about, but not 1st Armour Division.
Right. Well, let's go to Egypt then. You went to Egypt in February 38 with the 1st Light Battalion. These were equipped with light tanks?
At that time, I think, all with three-man light tanks, the Mark 5 and the Mark 6. I don't think there were any two-man light tanks left with them.
Yeah. Were these tanks you'd worked with before?
Yes, certainly the Mark V, and I think we were just getting Mark VIs.
Mm-hmm.
Meadows engine.
The period, I suppose, is of greatest interest for the formation of the armoured division under Hubbard. This brought together tank corps units with cavalry units.
Yes, when we went out in February 38 as a light battalion, we formed part of the Cairo Cavalry Brigade, which at that time consisted of the 6th Royal Tanks, who had two companies of medium tanks, the 1st Royal Tanks ourselves, all light tanks, the 7th Hussars, who had recently been mechanized with light tanks, the 8th Hussars, who were in Ford pickups with Vickers Berthier machine guns, and the 11th Hussars, who had been mechanized for quite a long time, who had the Rolls-Royce armored car. And there was third RHA, I think. And then when the Mobile Division Egypt was formed just about the time of the Munich crisis, that is later that year when Hobo came out, the division was formed of three groups: the Cairo Cavalry Brigade, from which the two, if I'm right, if I can remember, the first and the sixth tanks were removed and formed into another group, which were called the Heavy Armored Group. And a support group was formed, and initially of one motorized infantry battalion and one gunner regiment, which was half field guns and one anti-tank battery, I think. I've got it all written down here. And then this was expanded so that you had in the end two motor battalions, one gunner regiment with 25 pounders as field guns, and one gunner regiment which was both anti-tank and anti-aircraft.
Was the integration of previously independent units a smooth and a happy mix?
The mix in the Cairo Cavalry Brigade, the relations had always been extremely good between the cavalry and the tanks out there. We never had any trouble on that score.
Did the process give you any insight into the relative competence of tank corps units on the one hand and mechanized cavalry units on the other?
Well, it was a question partly of the type of people themselves and partly of how long they'd been doing it. The 11th Hussars were one of the first cavalry regiments to have been mechanized. They and the 12th Lancers had been mechanized, I think, since about 1933. 28 earlier, yes. And they were very competent in their own field. 7th Hussars had only very newly been mechanized and were pretty raw. The 8th Hussars, who were a fairly lackadaisical lot anyway, very nice, amusing, but very lackadaisical Irish lot, they certainly could not have been said to have been highly professional technically. Mm.
Can you give me any examples of the kind of ways in which this lack of professionalism, for whatever reason, demonstrated itself?
Well, they were always losing things and setting fire to things. Things like that. They had a great quartermaster who was supposed to have been... When they moved across the desert, we all moved out on an exercise to Mirza Matruh from Egypt, from Cairo, across the desert in the spring of 39, I think it was. And there were a great many breakdowns among the 8th Hussars. And our quartermaster, Bay Middleton, is supposed to have sent a message to all the Arabs in the desert beforehand that anybody who brought anything they found in the desert to the 8th Hussars on their arrival at Mirza Matruh would be amply rewarded. So they got it all back.
I'm interested in Herbert's training program. He has a terrific reputation as a trainer of armored forces. Can you tell me something about the kind of program he implemented when he came out to take over the division?
Well, he did a number of very important things. He set extremely high standards, in some cases too high, too unrealistic.
How do you mean?
Well, he would make people do a whole lot of things which were unrealistic in terms of the control you would expect to exercise, and not the sort of thing one would in fact do in wartime.
For example?
I mean, he set a recovery exercise, I remember, in which everybody was scattered all over the dead desert, a whole number of breakdowns and various things wrong with them. And then, sort of out of the blue, all these had to be found and recovered. Well, you don't, as a rule, operate sort of completely random like that. There is some way by which somebody would have known when that chap dropped off and more or less where he was and why. And although this was very good in lots of ways, this was Hobo's main fault, that in his enthusiasm for their very high standards, he would produce such totally unreal scenarios that not only did things then not often function very well, because he made it too difficult, but this caused, somewhat justifiably, considerable mistrust among other people, particularly his senior officers, in his judgment. And I believe they had some good reason to do so, because I think that a lot of the things, particularly in the light of one's experience afterwards, were totally unrealistic. But he did do an immense... One of the most important things he did was build up from scratch an efficient, workable system of supply in the field to armoured divisions and mobile formations working at great distances and over great distances, which hadn't existed before at all. And it was, in fact, the system which was then developed for the whole army throughout the Desert War, and indeed ever since. I mean, it was a total break away from what one was taught at Sandhurst and everything else like that, which was all based on the railway system of World War I. Well, first of all, although there was a railway, there was only one. he produced a mobile system of logistic support in all its aspects, including evacuation of casualties and everything like that, which just did not exist. Because there hadn't been a formation.
Did he actually develop that by practice there, or had he come with a sort of blueprint in his pocket?
No, it was developed, and he didn't come with a blueprint in his pocket, I don't think. It was developed. One of the key people throughout in this was his chief AQ officer, an RASC officer called Smith, who lives not all that far away from here, Weybridge now. He finished up as head of the RASC. I myself was involved in this quite a lot. And this was one of the major, one of his major contributions. It meant that when the war started in the desert, there was a functioning logistic system in the field, which just hadn't existed at all before he came.
As you were involved in it personally, can you tell me a bit more about how it was actually developed?
Well, it was developed from... a system was developed to ensure that, first of all, the units wheeled transport held fixed amounts of ammunition, petrol, spare parts and everything else, met up a system by which by radio and rendezvous and that sort of thing, it met up with the tanks after the day's fighting. It was based on a daily replenishment, although often afterwards one had to do it more frequently. And that then, those vehicles then went back to the divisional RASC columns who had their requirements, and they themselves went back to base. None of this existed before because there'd been no formation. I mean, there were no divisional RASC. There were just individual companies in Egypt and who hadn't practiced this sort of thing at all. They were just doing sort of taking stores up and down between the Canal Zone and Cairo. And then, of course, wireless had to be introduced to control these, and units had to have what was called a B-echelon commander with a wireless set. And parallel to this, a system of recovery of vehicles and repair in the field and recovery if they had back to mobile workshops. All this was developed in the very short time between his arrival, which was just before the Munich crisis, in the autumn, September 38, I think he arrived in August, and the time that in fact we went to war against the Italians in 1940. Of course, he'd left by that time. This was one of his major achievements. And the other thing was to force us to move and to navigate. Tremendous emphasis on navigation, and to move and navigate and find our way around the desert and do things at night, which again people had practiced before. General Pyle had made great thing of this in about 1935 in Egypt, I think. But this this was really exploited for the first time at the Battle of Sidi Barrani.
Yes. These things like night work, they were actually practiced in exercises conducted.
Well, what we did that was, well, in 1938, we were moved up to Mirza Matru in the Western Desert because everybody thought war was going to happen then. And once it saw it wasn't, we did a considerable period of exercises up in the desert there before we came back to Cairo. And then in 39, I think I'm right in saying, again the whole division moved up to the Mirza Matru area and spent quite a long time up there and exercised up there. And this, I think, was the time when Hobo got into trouble for using up track mileage in excess of what he'd been told he could have on training. Because there was a rule, a somewhat natural rule, that you'd got to keep certain overhaul mileage for engines and track mileage of the tanks in reserve in case the war started.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't want to suddenly find war started and all your tracks were worn out and all your engines were worn out.
There's a certain conflict here, isn't there, between maintaining your vehicles on the one hand and training
when you've got sufficient spares to be able to have regiments fully equipped plus tanks going through workshops and sufficient spare tracks and everything else so that you can replace them, the sort of thing one has now, the problem doesn't arise so much. But when you didn't have anything spare at all, then it was somewhat natural that GHQ, working under orders no doubt from the War Office, said that you must keep in hand, in case war breaks out, and war did look like breaking out in those days, every tank must have at least, say, 1,500 miles track mileage and 1,500 miles tank engine mileage in hand. He disregarded this and went well over those limits in training. It didn't matter in the end, because when war broke out in September 39 in Europe, it didn't break out there, because the Italians didn't participate until May 40.
Mm.
And when they did, they didn't do anything much.
It's one of the most musical tapes I'll have recorded, anyway. Was this another sort of example of the unrealism of Hubbard, which you mentioned earlier?
Well, of course, he's a very bolshy man. I mean, he disliked the establishment, and they disliked him. He was not inclined to take anything he was told, to do anything he was told normally, although very angry if people didn't do things that he told them. But he was a very unreasonable man in lots of ways. But the good thing about him was that he inspired everybody with enthusiasm and drove them very, very hard indeed, and it was the only way to get things done in those days.
You had, I think, two jobs during this period. First as a transport officer to the 1st Battalion, and secondly you became involved in desert reconnaissance patrols. Were these concurrent jobs or distinct?
Yes, they were concurrent, and I was also what was called adjutant of the divisional liaisonal, and that was concurrent too.
As transport officer, what kind of what range of responsibilities did you have?
Well, I was responsible for looking after all the wheeled vehicles in the unit and for organizing them and for seeing that on exercises or in war they were all properly loaded up and delivered, moved them around, delivered what they were meant to deliver at the right place at the right time. It was the whole business of the supply of the regiment in the field.
Mm-hmm. What were the biggest problems in that area for you?
Well, one of the main problems was, there were good vehicles on the whole, but it was keeping the vehicles fit, because constant use in the desert was very hard on them. It was very hard work on them indeed. Secondly, was keeping drivers well trained, both in desert driving over soft sand, which of course in the end we didn't do a great deal of because we were on the hard desert, but also that all the NCOs and even the drivers themselves understood some fairly simple navigation. because I mean, map reading was navigation. It was not you didn't read a map in the normal way. And the other was really adjusting the load that we were constantly having people. If you change the type of vehicle in the squadrons as we were then, or you, things were always changing about what sort of load you ought to have and how, what should be in every vehicle, and whether you should have mixed loads or whether you shouldn't. So one was constantly having to change all the rules and everything about loading. But it was an interesting job because one was one's own boss. You had really far more in, responsibility than a lieutenant in charge of just three tanks. And I did a number of other jobs on the side too. I mean, various experiments on new vehicles.
What kind of experiments? On what?
Well, there was a thing called a wheeled tank came out, which was a Nuffield sort of armoured car, really, with independent suspension and drive to each wheel, and I was made responsible for carrying out the trials on that.
Well, did you actually devise the trials, or did you carry out some trials
well,
which others designed?
Well, I did both, really.
What sort of trials did you put it through?
Well, the main thing was to get the thing to work at all, and then because it always overheated each time I took it out to start off with, and then the suspension used to start breaking up. In fact, I think you know, I probably committed the same sort of the sin as I was accusing Hobo of. I mean, I think I drove it too fast, too hard over too rough desert, which no vehicle would have stood up to do that. It certainly didn't stand up at all well, and was not heard of again.
Well, thanks to you. Well, any other vehicles that came through your hands and had to be trialled?
I don't think we got, not sure, no, it was later we got the earliest sort of American Jeep. No, that was much later, I think. I can't remember now, no.
Okay. On the desert reconnaissance work you did, Tank Corps had a lot of experience in the desert over quite a number of years. By the time you got out there, had most of the problems associated with desert navigation been solved?
Well, they'd been solved, except that, I mean, if you were a very expert desert traveller, so somebody like Bagnall, or what later became the LRDG, well, then you had a rather sophisticated type of sun compass, which meant that really you went, you followed the country, you went the way you went, and plotted as you went your course. Now, you couldn't expect the great bulk of the army to do this because it was, and indeed it wasn't quite what you wanted. So the sun compass one had was intended to make you go in a straight line and then check at intervals. And the problem was it involved a number of different plates. It was a somewhat delicate instrument which had to be adjusted every now and then. And the main problems were those of trying to find a reliable, simple sun compass which could be as cheap as possible so that as many vehicles as possible could have it. And something which, say, you could expect people, corporals and above all, to be able to operate happily and not be too expensive a thing to maintain. And this was really what we were after most of the time. But the standard sun compass we had at that time was a thing called the Evans-Lohm sun compass, which didn't fulfil those requirements. It was perfectly satisfactory if you knew how to use it and look after it, but it was not something that you could expect to be supplied to every vehicle.
Did you personally learn much yourself in these desert reconnaissance operations?
Deal. I think I learned more than perhaps at any other time about making one's own decisions and of command in its way. But, I mean, it embraced everything. I did one trip to Siwa and back to Siwa, round by the coast and back straight across. And I did a whole series of trips all through the summer of 39 based on Matru. And you had to work everything out yourself beforehand. You had to work out where you thought you were going to go, how much petrol you thought you'd use, what spares you'd want, all those sort of things. And you had to and see that the vehicles weren't overloaded, and you had to adjust it all to the vehicles themselves. And it was a nice balance between, I mean, if you over-insured, you've got too much weight, and you had to add on another vehicle, and then you needed more stuff. That and the fact that you frequently, we had no radio.